Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Now the impact of the health reform law on New York City. Mayor Bloomberg is weighing the good against the bad.
We have a $1 billion deficit for Health and Hospitals Corporation. We've got to plug that. We've spent an enormous amount of money on Medicaid. That keeps us from doing other things. The economic impact, whenever they raise taxes, is greater on New York City because this is where people come to make money.
So in that clip, some benefits he expects for the city, some costs he expects for the city. And with two views now on the impact of the law on the city, we have Greg David, former Crain's New York business editor-in-chief, now head of the business journalism program at the CUNY Graduate School of Journalism, and Elizabeth Benjamin, vice president of health initiatives at the Community Service Society, the New York think tank that advocates on behalf of the poor. Welcome back, both of you. Hello.
Hello, Brian.
Good morning.
And the stats that I've read say, Elizabeth, that there are more than 2 million uninsured New Yorkers right now, and that will go down by maybe 600,000. Are those the numbers that you would know?
No, I don't think that's quite right. I think there's 2.7 million. The latest census data would indicate there's 2.7 million uninsured New York State residents. And after health reform, we expect roughly 1.7 million to become insured.
Uh-huh.
So that's after 2014.
Okay, that would still leave 1 million uninsured New Yorkers. Why is that?
New York has there's sort of a bunch of different groups that would fall into this category. First and foremost, we are a place where immigrants are very welcome, and so there are a lot of immigrants have been somewhat left out in the health reform deal, and so they will probably not be able to access insurance easily.
The undocumented
Correct.
Or illegal immigrants in particular.
Correct. Unauthorized immigrants will not be basically eligible to get covered. So that they will continue to use the Health and Hospital Corporation's facilities, as Mayor Bloomberg indicated. And there's another group of folks. There are some people that just won't be able to, even with health reform, afford coverage. And so there'll be a group of those folks. I think there are also some exemptions for people who are religious. And, you know, there are some people who feel strongly that they shouldn't have to get covered, and that's part of their religious orientation. And so they will be left out as well.
Greg, anything to add on people being covered who are not insured now?
No, I think she's exactly right. And I think that, you know, you can look at the downside number, but look, we've got to say that that's a lot of people who will get coverage. They're going to get coverage through an expansion of the Medicaid program. They're going to get coverage through subsidies that will allow them to buy insurance. And some of them are going to get covered because many more small businesses are going to have to offer insurance. So for the uninsured, I think this is a major godsend.
Elizabeth in Washington Heights is calling in to say how she thinks this will affect her. Hi, Elizabeth. Elizabeth, are you there? All right, maybe not. Well, let's try Melissa on the Upper East Side. Melissa, you're on WNYC.
You're asking how it's going to help me, this new health care?
Affect you, positively
affect
or negative.
Me. It's going to affect me negatively, from what I understand. The extension of COBRA benefits was taken out of the bill. I happen to be unemployed. I've been unemployed for a year. I have both a bachelor's and a master's, and I'm having a hard time finding a job. Without this COBRA extension, I don't think I'm going to afford to be able to continue medical coverage.
To buy insurance. So, first of all, is that accurate?
I don't think that's right. I think the COBRA extension was passed for another month. It was always separate from the health reform bill. I think COBRA extension is still in effect. And so if you want some help with that, you can call. We have a helpline you can call, and we can help you sort of sort that out.
Right. The other thing to say about this, Brian, is that, and this is a very important point in the bill, many of the things don't kick in till 2013 and 2014.
Right.
But the caller in 2014, if unemployed, would be able to buy insurance because they wouldn't have much income, and there would be very substantial subsidies to help them do that. So it's not about today, but this person's circumstance in 2014, they would be able to buy insurance.
On the downside, Greg, your Crain's article on this this week says this is a triple whammy for wealthier families, those making more than $250,000 a year. What's the triple whammy?
Well, the first whammy is last year the state passed a millionaire's tax, which sharply increased income tax rates, although it starts, of course, well below a million, you know. The second whammy is that the Obama administration is going to allow the Bush tax cuts to expire in the near future. That will increase income tax rates on people who make a fair amount of money over about $250,000 and will increase the capital gains rate. This is the triple whammy because, first of all, we are increasing the Medicare tax on everyone, but we are now going to apply it to capital gains, dividends, and interest income of people who, as a family, make more than $250,000 and individuals more than $200,000. I saw an estimate yesterday from Peter King that New Yorkers will pay 20% of that new tax.
20% of that new tax.
Although there was, I just want to chime in here, there was an incredible article in the New York Times today about how this, the health reform measure really will be, for the first time, an important step forward to curbing inequality. And I think that's sort of the philosophical dilemma that's put on, you know, that this reform package presents to us. Is our country about the continued polarization of income groups, or is it about bringing, you know, groups more together? And I think this bill truly, as my colleague said today just now on the radio, it's about really a middle class deal and really helping working poor people, especially, you know, in New York, but all throughout the country, be able to access coverage. And, you know, our surveys show over and over again, the number one thing that folks say will help them, that the government could do for them, is helping them access health care.
And I guess you're referring to David Leonhardt's column in the Times, which is pretty striking. In the business section, he says this will close the wealth gap to some degree by making health insurance more accessible for more middle and working class people, and also notably for sick people who become poor because they can't get insurance, while taxing the rich more to pay for it. And I guess very few places have a bigger wealth disparity than New York City.
And also just 60% of all American bankruptcies happen in homes where people have health problems. So there's a total connection between becoming poor and having a health issue. And this could be, you know, this could finally be a thing of the past under health reform. And I think that's something to celebrate.
John, in Brooklyn, how do you think health reform affects you personally?
Well, I don't know. That's why I'm calling. I have a very small business. There's myself and three employees. And I guess I have no idea what my responsibilities are now going to be in terms of providing health insurance for my employees.
And responsibilities or opportunities, because you may be in for a subsidy. Greg, can you help John?
Yes, John, you are in the sweet spot here. Because you don't have 25 employees, you will not be required to buy health insurance, so you have no new requirement. And there will be subsidies for you to help you buy it.
Uh-huh.
So you're one of the most favored. Now, that those subsidies may depend on how much your workers make. I mean, if you're a hedge fund, forget it. But otherwise, you are one of the big small business winners in this bill.
Yeah, there's a tax credit of up to 35% of your part, a contribution of health insurance for your employees that will be effective this very year.
And so, I believe that's for companies with 25 or fewer employees where the average wages are $50,000 or less, correct?
And also for not-for-profits. That's another benefit.
And Brian, it is available for some, it will be available at some level for companies greater than 25, though the credit will phase out.
Uh-huh. Correct.
So as the way things have been working now is I get my personal insurance through the, you know, a group plan through my business. And I have the option to, you know, I have to offer it to my employees. These are young guys and they did not take it. But so what you're saying is if I offer them insurance and they agree to pay half or whatever percentage they pay, my part of it will get a tax credit?
Well, now it gets a little complicated because the kind of policy you offer is going to be regulated and you're not going to be able to pay just half. I'm not sure about the latest details, but some of the previous versions required you to pay 85%.
I think it's at least 50% of the total premium. That's what I've been reading.
The other thing to remember is that theoretically, at least, your employees will be required to have health insurance or pay a tax themselves. So presumably they will have an incentive to sign up, though whether people are going to be willing to do that or not, we have yet to see.
Interesting. We'll see. John, good luck. And we're talking about the impact of the health reform law specifically on New York City with Greg David, head of the business journalism program at the CUNY Graduate School of Journalism. He still writes for Crain's New York Business. He's got a piece on this very question this week. And Elizabeth Benjamin, vice president of health initiatives at the Community Service Society. Martin in Harlem, you're a family practitioner?
Yes. It looks like a boon to family practice. We're getting a 10% increase in our Medicare fees over the next 5 years. I'd like to see it permanent, but that's another question. And then Medicaid will go up by, I think it's 213, to Medicare fees. Right now, we take very little Medicaid in our office because we lose money whenever we see a Medicaid patient. Now we can take them, and if the Medicaid numbers do mirror the Medicare numbers, we will have a lot more patients that will be coming into our doors.
That's really interesting because, Elizabeth, we hear so much about how doctors in general are going to get squeezed by lower reimbursement rates. Martin says he's in a category, which is, family primary care physicians, who are actually going to get more for Medicaid and Medicare.
He's exactly right, and that's one of the, I think, the great things about this new bill is that they're going to, Medicaid will now be paying for primary care 100% of the Medicare reimbursement rate. So that is going to be an incredible boom for primary care physicians. The other thing that happens in the bill is there's more resources for community health centers, and, of course, there's a strong emphasis on preventive care. And so insurance companies will be providing, will not be doing a lot of cost sharing for preventive care and encouraging more people to get preventive care. So they've really thought this piece through quite nicely.
Greg, what about health-related profits or employment in the city? Healthcare, as you well know, has been a growing economic sector here, even during the recession. Any way to gauge what this will mean for the numbers of healthcare jobs in the city or profitability for health-related companies?
Well, the profitability for health-related companies, obviously, it's this legislation long-term is problematic for insurance companies, so we'll have to see about that. To the extent many more people are covered and use access health care more, it's generally going to be good for the industry. Now, the issue that you alluded to a moment ago is actually pretty important. For years, draconian cuts in Medicare reimbursement rates have been scheduled to go into effect. Each year, every time it becomes necessary, Congress puts off those cuts, cuts to doctors' fees, cuts to hospitals. This bill assumes those cuts are going to go into effect, and that's why the bill doesn't cost as much as it might have. So long-term, from a perspective of both the healthcare providers and how much this bill is going to cost, it's going to be very important to watch whether those cuts go into effect or not.
Do we count the stock market as an impact on New York? Judging from the last 2 days, Wall Street seems to like this, including the healthcare sector liking it, maybe even the insurance companies. So maybe the socialist takeover of healthcare is good for capitalism, including New York, or is that a leap?
That was a leap, Brian. There were lots of other factors at work on the stock market's rise in the last couple of days. And anyway, what the stock market does day to day, boy, it's, you know, like a lie. I don't believe any of those stories the market rose because of this or that. Nobody knows.
Yeah, well, I did look at the Wall Street Journal website yesterday right after the market closed, and it said, quote, stocks finished strongly higher as Wall Street relished more certain footing with health reform legislation signed by President Obama.
You know, you're right, Brian. I teach my students how to write those stories, and I tell them to understand when you're writing those stories, nothing you're writing in them is true.
Howard in Sheepshead Bay, how do you think health reform will affect you?
Hi. I think initially my taxes are going to go up slightly, but I've got a bigger question, which is, haven't we all been paying for the uninsured when they show up at the hospital sick and getting all those services anyway? I think eventually our taxes and other fees will go down. Short term up, long-term down. Thank you.
He's exactly right. We do spend an enormous amount of money on uncompensated care. In New York State, our bad debt and charity care pool is worth $1 billion, and that is generated from various taxes, actually on people's hospital admissions. And there are other disproportionate share fund, hospital funding. There's lots and lots of, you know, tax revenues that are going to hospitals and medical providers to help pay for the uninsured. And so one of the nice things that will happen as a result of this bill is that there will be fewer and fewer uninsured and less of a need to pay for uncompensated care.
Do you have any stats? The stat that I've seen as, you know, the present state of things, and correct me if this is wrong, is that about $3.5 billion in 2008 were spent by New York City hospitals on medical care for uninsured patients. How would you expect that to change?
I think after 2014, if you know, we can assume that that will go down, but you know, that there will be less than half of the folks that will be needing that. I mean, it's sort of extraordinary, because if 1.7 million people suddenly have coverage, those folks, those 1.7 million people, will be fee-paying patients at the hospitals instead of non-fee paying patients. So it's quite a big impact. And the health reform bill actually tried to calculate that and reduce some of the disproportionate share hospital funding, which is the funding that goes for uncompensated care folks, and they kind of reduced it over time. New York City hospitals were very concerned about that and fought very hard to have the amount of reduction eased, and for good reason, because we do have many immigrants and many people that might not benefit from health reform.
And related to that, Democratic Congressman Elliot Engel of the Bronx and Westchester and Rockland had threatened to vote against the bill unless it stopped cheating New York State, as he saw it, out of federal funds for being a so-called do-gooder state on Medicaid,
yeah,
that is, with generous Medicaid benefits.
Right.
Engel did ultimately vote for the bill. Was the problem that he cited addressed?
Yes, it was. I saw his editorial, and I disagreed with it, because I think he didn't take into account that we would be getting $25 billion in actual subsidies to help people buy quality, affordable coverage, and that was never part of that calculus. And we are also going to be getting $30 billion in Medicaid funding. The concern is that originally, in the original proposal, New York, having already expanded our Medicaid programs, would not be getting the same deal as other states in terms of reimbursing us at a higher level. We get 50% reimbursement for providing Medicaid coverage for these folks. In some of the other states in health reform, like Nebraska, we're going to get 100% reimbursement. And New York was very distraught at that idea. In the end, we prevailed, and the whole sort of system has been regularized in a way that, you know, the Medicaid funding will go up incrementally on a fair basis for those do-gooder states, and that's a good thing.
Let's get one more call in. Elizabeth in Washington Heights, how do you think this is going to affect you?
Well, I think that my flexible health care spending account is going to be cut in half, because right now it's $5,000, and it's going to get cut to $2,500. And we may have to pay a surcharge on our health insurance plan through my husband's job, because it's a pretty decent plan. He's a middle manager in the city.
That would be the so-called Cadillac health tax,
yeah,
if it applies. That doesn't take effect until 2018, you know.
Right, but, you know, hopefully he'll still have a job in 2018 that still has good health insurance, and I suspect we're going to wind up getting taxed on that. So I think it's going to wind up costing us money, but I think it's a good idea, and I support it.
And is she right about the flex plan, Greg? That's many people at work can take health care, can designate a certain amount of money to put away pre-tax into a certain account and then use it for health care. Is there going to be a cap on that of $2,500?
I don't know that specifically.
I haven't heard anything
the details,
like that.
Yeah, the details in the bill went back and forth. But it is true, Brian, that this bill is anti the market initiatives that were put in. It's against not so much the flexible spending accounts, but the high deductible plans and health savings accounts. That sort of attempt to have people control their health care, that is not in keeping with the philosophy of the bill, and those efforts are going to be restricted.
The other thing to mention is that there will be less of a need for flexible spending accounts, because there will be caps on how much you're expected to pay out of pocket. So I think there's a real sort of, you know, a balancing act that the bill is trying to strike there.
We did, by the way, confirm it just now that, yes, in fact, there would be a $2,500 cap. on flexible spending accounts. Well, how do you think that would really work, Elizabeth? I mean, for a lot of people who have, let's say, moderate amounts of health care expenses, but for a family, it certainly could go over $2,500 a year so easily just with normal deductibles and premiums and copays, you know, even if you're insured at work for part of that. Where are these caps going to come into effect that make up the difference?
Well, I think the first thing is that they're going to regularize the kind of insurance products people are going to be able to buy, and so the actuarial values of some of the products will go up, which means the amount you have to spend versus the insurance company is going to go up quite a bit. So there will be better benefit packages out there, and I guess my point is that because people will have better quality insurance, there will be less of a need to rely on flexible spending gaps programs, because that's why we use them, is because our insurance, the way insurance has been working recently, is they keep putting more and more cost sharing on regular people. And so that's why we have to go to flexible spending accounts.
Well, I thought wasn't addressed in this bill. But by the way, the $2,500 limit on flex accounts goes into effect in 2013 for anybody wondering if that affects you. Greg, a last word on the future that Elizabeth just laid out there. Do you think we're really going to see the costs go down and the insurance be that much more comprehensive? I thought that they really didn't address copays and deductibles and stuff and how they're going up in the private sector.
Well, actually, the bill is very, as Elizabeth said, it puts in all these requirements. So let me make two quick points. One, I stand with the mayor on this. There's nothing that will cut costs in this bill. It's not health reform, and it's not going to work in that regard. Two, small businesses in New York that are a little larger are at great risk. If they have more than 50 employees, they're going to have to buy very expensive insurance, probably much more expensive than they buy now. They don't get many subsidies. And by the way, more than a third of companies with between 25 and 100 people do not currently offer insurance. It's going to be a big problem for that group and probably restrain growth. For all those comments you hear about how the future of New York rests with small companies, this bill will be a huge hurdle.
Well, that's it for Elizabeth Benjamin and Greg David, except you guys can hang around and hear this, because on our website today, as we mentioned at the top, we are collecting your Joe Biden health reform haiku. And haiku, as you may know, is a 575 form of poetry, and Biden's R-rated health reform headline from yesterday happens to contain seven syllables. So he said this is a big blanking deal. So use that as the middle line and put your five syllables before it, five syllables after it, and we have some coming in already. Health reform is a law, writes
Brian,
John.
Could I just give
1 second, Elizabeth. This is a big blanking deal. Republicans scream. Another one, Patty wrote, just speak in my mind. This is a big blanking deal. Oops, was that out loud? Elizabeth, did you want to disagree with Greg on that final point?
No. I mean, I would love to, but what I really wanted to do is I was concerned that the woman who had the COBRA issue didn't get our phone number, and I wanted to make sure that if people had problems that they knew where to call, and that would be 212-614-5400.
Give it again.
212-614-5400.
Thank you very much. Elizabeth Benjamin from the Community Service Society. Greg David, formerly with Crain's New York Business, now head of the Business Journalism Program at the CUNY Graduate School of Journalism. Thank you both so much.
Thank you, Brian.
And coming up in a minute, the Googleization of diplomacy, and we will get the latest on the hacking of Google in apparent retaliation for its opening up speech in China.